the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and the Bureau of Development Services to explore that issue and bring us back some recommendations. What can we do or what should we do about better controlling hazardous materials on the site? We got testimony earlier about other cities, Tualatin, I have their application here, Lake Oswego, their application here for a demolition permit, and in their cases, they do require a more comprehensive approach to mitigating the potential environmental hazards that are involved. So it's one that we ought to at least explore.
So just to clarify on that, though, we have made changes in the Bureau of Development Services application process that didn't need to come to council on that.
Oh, okay, good.
So that
good. So we may not have to do anything in code.
Well, I think planning and sustainability could continue to look to enhance that,
okay.
But we have made some changes, and as you say, yeah, we don't need to necessarily make it in code.
Yeah, so we're going to keep looking at that issue, and then most specifically on two other points, I am going to put a proposal forward in my proposed budget to update the historic inventory because we know we need to do that. We are way behind. I think there's a strong interest on the council in getting that work done. It will affect this issue and a lot of others. It costs money, and it will take staff time, but I think it's worth doing. And then finally, I'm going to ask the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to come back with some proposed new standards for infill and redevelopment and take up some of these issues that have been described. We are going to ask for public involvement in that, so obviously if you're interested in that, let my office or the Planning Bureau's office know. I know there are a lot of people here in this room and in the community that have expressed an interest in working on those questions of what do we do short of perhaps outright single-family design review, which I don't frankly think is practicable, but to change the setbacks, to change the height, to change the lot coverage requirements in order to achieve more compatibility. Those are, at least in my mind, the rough parameters for what we might adjust to try to address some of these issues of the scale of what's being done through redevelopment and infill versus what's there already in the neighborhood. So again, in none of these cases do I think I or the Bureau or my office have this all figured out yet, but in each case I think we want to go on from the first set of issues which Commissioner Fritz and the Bureau brought forth here to deal with demolition itself, and then look at those front-end issues of what is our planning code encouraging or discouraging, allowing or not allowing in the form of development, what are we regulating about the impact of demolition in terms of these environmental issues? And then again, have we got a proper inventory of the historic buildings in our city? No, we don't. We need to update it. So those are follow-on actions that some combination of the Planning Bureau and the Bureau of Development Services and probably some others as well are going to be tasked with based on where we've gotten so far in this discussion. So I just wanted to respond with those points now because, again, we've got more people signed up. But what we're going to now be acting on based on the discussion so far is this set of amendments. So please do focus your comments today for those who have signed up now to really focus on the amendments today and understand that those other issues are going to come back to the council, in some cases in a fairly short time.
And Mayor, my understanding is that the Housing Commissioner is going to be looking at the request about
right.
Could there be
there's an affordability issue there as well, which is how do we perhaps support infill, support home ownership, affordable home ownership through revenues derived from demolition. I know, Dan, you and the Bureau want to look at that question. So,
Mayor, can I ask a couple questions?
Sure.
First, I really appreciate the scope of the issues you've tasked people to come back to us on. With respect to hazardous materials generally, since I now have some direct experience with this in my neighborhood.
Yes, you do.
And because I believe that houses built in the 20s in particular are more likely to have at least two kinds of hazardous materials that would be of some I appreciate that Commissioner Fritz said that the Bureau of Development Services is addressing that in some way. What I would appreciate is just some written follow-up to explain what is the status of that issue.
Okay.
What I can do my own homework, but if someone could point to me to what the code provisions are and how we regulate that, number one.
Well, Director Paul Scarlett is here. He could give a 30-second summary of what we're doing on that issue if you'd like.
That's fine, but I don't want to hold people up also testifying.
Okay.
Number two, Mayor, on the question of the potential, what Commissioner Saltzman is going to look at on potentially a fee for affordable housing, and the other issues that you've identified, what's the time frame that you're going to set for something coming back to us?
Yeah, I think it's, and some of these things are going to take longer than others. On the issue of hazardous materials, I think that one can be done pretty quickly, probably 90 days. What are we doing now? What more should we consider? But Paul, why don't you come respond to that and see if that's a reasonable timeline.
With anybody else that you want to bring.
He's not Mary Helen.
Yeah. You have to guess which is which. I just want to respond to the hazardous.
Mary Helen, just put your name in.
Mary Helen Kincaid, DRAC Chair. We've had meetings, DRAC, BDS staff, with the state, and Chris Zimmer was here the last time testifying from the state about hazardous waste materials and his work with the staff. Paul can speak to the what's on the permit application, but we've also arranged for a gentleman by the name of Tim Lenahan, who's from the OCCB, I don't know, and OSHA and DEQ are going to do a presentation at the ONI Neighborhood Summit on hazardous material handling regulations, and also be there supposedly someone from Representative Lou Frederick's staff, who's looking at modifications for the state regulations regarding hazardous materials, because that's who handles those on site. And then they're also having conversations with BDS inspectors of how they can interact when the inspector's on site and might see something, how they contact the state, because those conversations never happened before we started this whole process. So we've made great strides, but there's still a lot that can be made. So,
Paul, on the question of, say, a 1929 bungalow that's taken down to the foundation and replaced by a substantially bigger house.
Yes.
I know in my neighborhood it's at least possible that there's asbestos and lead paint, and maybe more so in the basements, but could be elsewhere. There are dumpsters that are set up where materials are disposed of. These things happen very, very quickly. What is the regulatory framework to make sure that there's no adverse impact?
Paul Scarlett, BDS Director, so appreciate that question. A distinction is that those sort of health conditions are managed and enforced through the state DEQ. So to provide information to permit applicants and customers in neighborhoods, we have updated our permit application form to include information about which agency is responsible for those aspects. And so with the asbestos and lead paint issues, BDS, or City of Portland, is not the primary regulator or enforcer. So we have communicated who is, and it's part of the permit application, which can be gathered by anyone looking at it. So there's coordination. We've reached out to the state and
just since we have you, it sounds a little bit like what we have with cell towers, where there are certain health issues we're preempted from taking up, but here it's dealt with by another agency.
That's right.
So if someone were to come into the house in my neighborhood that had asbestos in the basement and to abate it, they would come in looking like astronauts, and there'd be it'd be set up so that nothing leaks, and the materials would have to be taken out in a safe way and then disposed of. When a house is just demolished in a day or so, what's the safety components to make sure that there's no asbestos or lead that gets kicked into the air?
I actually don't know the specifics of it. We do have builders here that have gone through that process and know the requirements because it's imposed upon them.
I can add one little thing. When they apply for a demolition permit, there's a box that they have to check that they're aware of state regulations, and if they apply to their situation, and they've been provided information, and if it's applicable to their, I don't know the exact wording, but that they will comply with state regulations, and they check those. The state's very happy for that, because then if they receive a complaint, like you call the number that's posted and says, they're tearing the house down and nobody's in their spacesuits or, you know, hazmat suits. Then when the state comes out, they have proof that they said that they knew, and prior to that, they did not have that. So that's sort of one big piece that was put together. It's a complaint-driven thing, so it's not perfect. But when they apply for the permit, probably Rob, who does permits, could speak much better to that.
Go ahead, Rob, please.
Rob Humphrey. I own a company called Faster Permits, so I expedite many thousands of permits in the city of Portland and throughout the country. Most of my builders, well, every one of my builders, conducts a lead and asbestos survey before they even really come to me for permits. So, like in the case of the city of Lake Oswego, they simply require the same checkbox. Did you get a lead and asbestos survey beforehand? And the answer is always yes, we did. And if asbestos and lead is found in that survey, you just show that it has been mitigated properly through the proper channels. And because it's regulated by state agencies, the contractors risk losing their CCB licenses if they don't do their mitigation. So that's helpful.
That does help.
Is the lead and asbestos survey a public record?
Yeah, it would be like in the case of a city that collects that data, like Lake Oswego, I'm sure it's part of their public record. I don't think the city of Portland collects that data as part of a demolition permit. But
if we required it to be attached to the permit, for example.
I know it becomes part of the file in Lake Oswego.
Okay. That's worth noting.
Is it your professional opinion that state law is adequate to address whatever the health impact is?
You know, I think there are folks out there that might demo a house that didn't do the lead and asbestos mitigation in jurisdictions that don't require, you know, proof that you mitigated for lead and asbestos. But I think those are very, very few. As I said, every builder that I've represented has, if you ask, they've got it. They've always got it.
Thank you.
Welcome. Okay. Thank you all. Any other questions for them? So, again, in terms of timeline on these things, what I have in mind is that the deconstruction incentive and the hazardous materials issues can both be addressed pretty quickly, maybe in a matter of 90 days or so before we can see a proposal.
Well, that's my point. We think we're done on hazardous materials.
Well, but you don't think we have to do anything else regulatorily at the city level?
No. In addition
to what we've done already?
Right.
Okay.
Why is that, Commissioner?
Why is that?
Because I've thought that was what they just explained.
Well, but we're not attaching the survey to the permits yet, right?
We don't review that. It's reviewed by the state. So we're requiring the applicants to say that, yes, they've done the forms that they need to by the state.
Well, you know, one of the things I'll do is, since there's a project in my street, I'll ask the developer just to see the survey and see the mitigation thing. But what I don't want to do is foreclose the discussion before we know whether there's a problem.
Right.
And not in any way implying that BDS doesn't have an adequate system in place, but just my anecdotal evidence is this is an area that's handled rather casually, and I don't think it's of great comfort to an adjacent property owner that it's a concern of some state agency when it's happening in our backyard.
That's why, remember, we weren't necessarily asking for a specific regulatory proposal in this case, but for a report back. So we can decide when we see that report whether we think it's adequate or not, whether our current practice is adequate or not.
We can give you the report of what we've been doing for the last 8 months. I'm really concerned with adding more and more tasks to the Bureau of Development Services at a time when permits are coming in faster than we can process them, when we're supposed to be working on the Regulatory Improvement Code project, when we have the ITAP computer program that we're trying to implement and is getting behind schedule. As this process, yes, there's lots and lots and lots of things that we would like to discuss and like to have development services staff working on. There's a finite number of people who are able to work on them, and the more we keep adding in this project, we're missing our other priorities for the work plan and getting behind schedule on them. So we can certainly provide a report on this and what we've done, and council can give us feedback on whether you'd like to fund more staff.
It might require additional staff.
Yes.
A lot of this work might require additional staff. I understand that. That's why some of these have a budget impact.
Let me just be clear, Mayor. I'm not asking that we set up a task force to review this, but I would like to have a better sense of what the existing regulatory framework is.
Right.
And it may very well be that the folks at BDS have some views about how to strengthen it. They may not have the resources to do it. It may not be in our priority bucket list, but I would like to know that.
Yeah, same here. And then on the other two issues, infills, you know, changing our infill standards, that's going to be a longer process of necessity because it involves a lot of people. That's probably a year-long process. I know people would like us to change them. Some people would like us to change those standards tomorrow morning. But realistically, that's not going to happen that quickly. And again, I'm going to have the Planning Bureau tell us how much that's going to cost because that's not going to be free either. And likewise with the historic resources inventory, that's a year-plus process because, again, it's a citywide inventory. So both of those are going to involve more time, 12 months plus, and certainly in those cases require additional expenditure that we have to consider in the budget process. So one of the reasons I'm timing this now is that we're going to all be developing a budget here pretty shortly, but I intend to put funds in place in my proposed budget to fund those projects once the Planning Bureau tells me what the price tag is and gives us a schedule of what it should look like. Okay, thank you for indulging us in a little process management here, but I hope that helps for those that are concerned about those issues like deconstruction and infill standards and historic buildings. Now we'll move on to the amendments at hand for those that want to testify on those today and start calling on folks that have signed up.
Okay, I have about 42 people signed okay. up. First three, please come on up, are Vic Remmers, Luke Morley, and Eric Thompson. And they'll be followed by Rich Castlebaum, Don Castlebaum, and Rob Humphrey.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Go ahead, Mr. Remmers.
I'm Vic Remmers. I got a question. Can I give a few things to you guys before I go?
Sure. Give them to Carla. She'll pass it around. Thanks. And let her know if you want it back or not.
You got it.
All right, thank you.
All right, good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of City Council, for giving me the opportunity to give input on the proposed new demo delay policy. My name is Vic Remmers, and I'm a current resident in the City of Portland. I've lived in Portland my entire life, and I'm also one of the owners of Everett Custom Homes, a local new home builder. At Everett, we've been building new homes in the City of Portland for the last 5 years. I'm in support of the new concept of the 35-day notification period. However, I feel the additional 60-day extension is too long, and I would like to encourage the council to consider an alternative. Over the past 5 years, I've attended neighborhood meetings regularly to share upcoming projects with the neighborhoods and to get input from them. Throughout all these meetings and conversations over the years, there's only been one instance that neighbors were able to come together and purchase a home. In all of the dealings that we've had with the interested parties, we've usually been able to figure out a conclusion within about a week. If they want to move the house or if they would want to purchase it from us. The next concern I have is safety. In the past year, we pulled 26 demo permits, and half of those we used deconstruction services. On every single one of those jobs, we experienced break-ins, squatters, crime, drugs, and even prostitution in the rundown houses. We all know this is not the type of activity that people want in their neighborhoods. The homes that are being slated for demo or deconstruction are the homes that have been neglected and left vacant. All of the asbestos is being removed prior to demo, and I'd be happy to talk about it after you guys had a lot of questions about it. The materials are being recycled, or if deconstruction is used, they're being donated to the rebuilding center. Our company created our own demo door hanger, which I gave to you guys, that you guys can take a look at. I also brought some before and after pictures for you guys to look at. One other thing that is kind of being neglected is there's so many positive things that these new homes are bringing. They're much more sustainable than the old ones. They use less energy, less power. The new homeowners' utility bills are a fraction of those in the older houses. We're building homes close to the city in walkable neighborhoods and close to transit. And on top of all of that, there's hundreds of jobs created every day for each one. Another factor in these delays is heard is it makes it more difficult to provide affordable houses. It costs $5,000 to $15,000 a month in delays in our costs if we have to delay it. And so, in conclusion, I support the 35 days, but the 60 days I think is too much.
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Luke Morley, and I'm part of the family that owns Lakeside Lumber. We've been around since 1937. Seems like only yesterday. I have two perspectives on the proposal I'd like to share. The first is as a member of the Portland home building industry. The Portland home building market is unique, and that large national builders have never really gained any traction in this market. Consequently, the typical Portland home builder is really a small local business owner, and a good number of them are family-run businesses just like Lakeside Lumber. Every time they build a home, they're right in the vicinity of 100 checks to local suppliers, trade contractors, and real estate professionals, and most of those are local, small local businesses and some family-run businesses like Lakeside. Sorry, my voice is a little bit dry. As a result, the positive impact of the home building industry on Portland's economy, and in particular small business owners, cannot be understated. We've got a broad mix of customers at Lakeside, everything from weekend do-it-yourselfers to builders who construct highly complex, energy-efficient homes. The McMansions may get their attention on this issue, but we see a variety of homes to include a good number of smaller, affordable starter homes in our mix of business. Ironically, I've been on the other side of this issue. Although I did not grow up in Portland, I have a 92-year-old mother who lives in that same house that my father grew up in, and her neighbor was a widower with no children. And when he died, he was living in a one-story, 1,200-square-foot house, and the new owner wanted to tear it down and put up a three-story, high-level condominium project. And so I believe I got an appreciation for some of the neighborhood concerns on this issue. That said, though, a lot of time, effort, and thought has gone into crafting this proposed amendment. The nature of compromise is that rarely makes everyone feel completely happy about the result. However, I believe this proposal does a good job of attempting to balance the interests of the neighborhoods and local business, and I recommend that you pass this measure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Mr. Mayor and members of the council, my name is Eric Thompson. I'm a small local builder here in Portland with an emphasis on small and local. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian and a longtime Portland resident. My one-person company builds about 10 houses annually in the city of Portland, with most of them resulting from demos. Kind of to tap into what Mr. Morley was saying, each house is touched by hundreds of workers. Most of them either own or work for a local small business, many of them being tax-paying Portland residents. Virtually all of our demos are of houses that are beyond repair. In fact, last week we tore down a house in the Hawthorne area for a custom client, and their kids had nicknamed it the Stinky House. And we had neighbors coming up thanking us and thanking the new owners for getting rid of a neighborhood eyesore. I think it's interesting to note that the remodeling business is thriving in Portland. There were some numbers that were shared earlier about the number of major remodeling permits, not to mention minor ones. And that tells me that homes that are worth saving aren't necessarily being torn down, but rather they're being rehabbed, and I can't compete against a house that has value in the existing structure to build a new house there. I think there's an image of a big out-of-town developer merely building spec homes for the highest price that they can sell them for. Well over half of our homes are customs, which means we're coming in for the homeowner who already owns the teardown house, tearing it down for them, and those people happen to be Portland residents. All of our homes are selling quickly, which tells us that we're filling a need, again, for Portland residents. Putting restrictions on what can and can't be done with a particular property results in lower values for the property owners who choose to sell it, perhaps maybe even as part of their retirement. And again, these are Portland residents, that you're putting restrictions on their property that they're choosing to sell. And adding additional restrictions, regulations, delays only increases the fees and other costs that we as builders ultimately pass along to our buyers, resulting in houses that are less affordable. So in summary, adding lengthy and unwarranted delays to the demo process impacts current property owners and future home buyers, not just home builders like myself. And while I think the proposed changes to the demo policy are much more onerous to builders than they have been, they're a compromise that I can support. And they clearly achieve the goal of providing neighbors with advance notice of an approaching demo, which was the genesis of the discussion in the first place. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you all.
The next three are Rich Castlebaum, Don Castlebaum, and we'll go with Tony Nichols. And they'll be followed by Jim Huer, Wendy Chung, and Sarah Long.
Good afternoon. I'm Richard Castlebaum. I live in Oregon City. I'm a developer and builder, about 17 years in the city of Portland. And I want to make three points, one on availability of land and one on affordability and one on the voices of the people who aren't here. Regarding land, you know, every time we tear down a home, we usually put up two or three new ones in it. And what that's doing is saving land and sprawl from outside the city saving down and cutting our trees and forests and our farmland. So there is a lot of positive benefit to the city allowing demolitions and to go on forth and allowing us to take one lot into three. Affordability, every restriction, every zoning code, every delay causes additional cost to our homes, whether it be through the development or through the building process. And I realize and support a lot of regulations for the benefit of, whether it be health or safety or the benefit of the community. Just to be recognized, though, that some of these regulations do add cost and time, and those jack up the cost of a home ultimately to the homeowner. We do a lot of both infill starter homes and custom homes, so, you know, our starter home customers will feel that pinch the worst when you start to add new regulations and new restrictions on what the home's going to do. There are a lot of people here, neighbors that we have torn down homes in their neighborhood, and they've been very pleased with the result. They're very glad that we tore that home down because it's usually a derelict home or it's a home that's not taken care of, and that's an eyesore to the neighborhood. And when we come in, we try to match our project to the neighborhood feel so that 98% of the time we have a positive effect on the neighborhood.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Hi.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Dawn Kassebaum, and I had no idea that my husband and I would be testifying together, but here we are. So I'm here to represent our company, Bluestone Homes. I'm a native Oregonian, and I've lived in the Portland metro area most of my life. Bluestone employs my husband, of course. He's also a native Oregonian. And myself, our bookkeeper, and we recently added our adult daughter who has joined us to eventually take over our business. We've worked exclusively within the city of Portland, building new homes for the past 18 years. On the average, we hire over 30 subcontractors for each project, as well as purchasing materials from local suppliers. We are a local company, hiring local people, and purchasing from local vendors. I'm testifying on behalf of the HBA and the infill builder community. This week, I went through our records and determined that in the past 18 years, we have been building infill homes. There have only been four times that we have demolished a home to build new ones. Each structure we demolished was an eyesore into the street and was considered dilapidated with a property value held in the land, not in the structure. I have submitted some photos of before and after for your review later. In every one of our projects, no one contested or complained about the demolition. In fact, most neighbors, as my husband mentioned, were glad that the eyesore would be replaced, and they verbally told us so. In every instance, our new homes have created livability in the neighborhoods in which we built, provided increased taxes for the city, and in one situation, proceeds of the sale were used by an elderly owner to pay for her care and health needs. There are two criteria in the revisions that I consider a priority in the ordinance at hand. The extension of the delay period be limited to 60 days. Again, I believe the 60-day extension is a compromise for the property owners and is not ideal for any of the stakeholders represented here. However, the 60-day extension is a huge improvement over the existing 120 days. The longer the property sits vacant, as Mr. Remmers testified, you have all kinds of negative behavior involved. And then the other item that I think is a priority is the request for a delay be accompanied by an appeal fee or an appeal waiver. I believe without a fee or a fee waiver, the frivolousness of the appeals will increase. Obviously, there are neighbors in the city who do not wish to see new infill development take place. If all it takes is a letter to put a 120-day delay to a process that is seen as negative, then this will be used as a tactic to create a burden to the property owner and the neighborhood with no actual expectation that the demolition will be prevented nor any plan to save the structure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Tony Nichols. I'm on the board of the Laurelhurst Neighborhood Association. I'm not here on its behalf, but we struggled with the Markham House demolition. I thought there's some analogous things that might help understand why this code was so hard to fix. This is a 40-year-old conversation, and I think we're putting the cart before the horse a little bit. and it's affecting this law. The thing is that we had someone come by the Markham House. He came to us, and he said he was going to tear it down, build two houses. And the neighbors in McCullough Construction worked very hard, and they saved the home. And saving homes is nice, but you know, sometimes you pay your neighbor to tear down their house. And the thing is that half of this is about what goes up in in place of that house. So what she was just saying, the presumption that the request for the extra delay is going to be made in bad faith comes from the fact that we have not yet addressed any of those issues. Mm-hmm. So the assumption is that we're going to hide all of our concerns under the guise, dress them up as philanthropy, and request the delay. And that's true. That's what's happening. Because we haven't addressed those issues. The thing is that in this case, the request for the extra delay is the threat that brought the owner to the table. So if there's a disincentive, then the parties can work it out ahead of time. The thing is that this isn't fair. The extra delay isn't fair to the builders, to the neighbors. And what you need is a clear, formal disincentive that allows the parties to work it out, or something ahead of time like, you know, I mean, in an imaginary world, if you had, you know, limited the amount you could make in rebuilding your home, you wouldn't tear it down in the first place. The thing is that you're putting this burden on neighborhood associations, and we haven't done the job yet of creating a code that it's not about net loss anymore. We have an interest in our neighbors' homes, and this says that the only way I can avoid my neighbor doing something that affects my property value is to buy his house. So the idea of no one's going to be able to do this except for the elite. So until we get disincentives into the code to limit the number of demolitions that we have in general, the idea that it's in bad faith it doesn't help anyone. In the 83 report, it said, you know, we'd love to have everybody go through a hearings thing. If you had a threshold of that the builder had to have a hearing and pay for it unless, like an annexation, everybody signed off on it. I don't have the answers, but this code is the opposite of, and it's being pressured and twisted because of it. So I think we need to hold off, had some interim process, and have the city take care of that rather than force us to be the bad guy. And then you could learn from those hearings. You could learn what the issues are, and then address this code, because this has been so tortured that it's just bad. It's backwards.
Well, no, thank you. The other approach is of course this for now, and those other issues that I mentioned later.
I understand, but it's just that I don't think we've addressed that conversation, and that's what's causing this assumption that the presumption. If the presumption was on the builder, that at least motivates them to negotiate with the neighbors. And I mean, it's the neighboring interest in their home, which is a legally, a really hard thing to. We have the state code saying we can't designate homes. I mean, the Oregon idea that you have an interest in my house is very hard to take, and we haven't yet come up. We haven't faced that yet. So all I'm saying is that's what's causing the problem in fixing this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all.
The next three are Jim Huer, Wendy Chung, and Sarah Long. and they'll be followed by Barbara Stronis, Barbara Kerr, and Janet Baker.
Oh, you got slides? Okay. Carl will help you back. Go ahead, please.
My name is Jim Hoyer, and I'm speaking today to introduce testimony by the United Neighborhoods for Reform. You are familiar with the organization. We're a grassroots group dedicated to stemming the epidemic of demolitions. First, Mayor Hales and commissioners, we would like to thank you all for responding to our citizen cry for help that emerged during the summer. It's been a long road and a great deal of work by yourselves, by DRAC, BDS, and other city staff, not to mention hours of our time has gone into this. We now have a recommendation from the DRAC committee, which UNR has decided to support, albeit with serious reservations. The current proposal is an example of the saying, politics is the art of the possible. There is a lot in the proposed ordinance that we not only like but urgently need. There are other aspects that, quite frankly, don't achieve our goals, and you've heard already about some of those, and you'll probably hear some more. We ultimately supported this recommendation on the strength of three considerations. First is the Council's commitment on December 17th to schedule a review of the new provisions in 18 months. We intend to hold you to that commitment and to insist that such review be conducted by a body with vastly better balance than the Development Review Advisory Committee, which, having membership of 13 developers out of 17, is not the best venue for making broad policy affecting all Portland residents. Secondly, we intend to monitor the application of the new definitions to make sure that they achieve their attendant goals. And thirdly, we intend to seek a better way to save more viable, affordable houses that are slated for demolition. Simple delays, be they 120 days or 60 days, have been a feeble solution. Demolitions of up to 370 affordable houses a year, valued at $100 million, dwarfs the city's efforts at spending $20 million to support affordable housing. Can we really achieve affordable housing through demolition? But the work is not done. Lead paint and asbestos dust is still being scattered from demolition sites, and hearing the discussion today, there's still some misunderstanding about where we stand on those regulations. Deconstruction is still all too rarely employed, and our next speakers will have much to say about these subjects.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Ms. Chung, welcome.
Mayor Hales, commissioners, good afternoon. I'm Wendy Chung. I'm from the NWDA. And I know, Mayor Hales, you asked us not to speak about anything but the amendment. You should know that there have been 40 demolitions, somebody's already said that, I think, since the last time I was here to speak to you about this. So obviously, like you said, we have this urgent problem that has to be addressed immediately. But the Laurelhurst fellow who testified before us brought up a good point, which is that remember the reason that we all are here to begin with, the reason we started looking at the demo delay rules was because of the issue of demolition generally. And I just wanted to talk about a couple of things that you mentioned in your interview with OPB that I think inform your decisions, not necessarily about both related to this ordinance, but also related to the other things that you were talking about. So, you rejected two fallacies during that interview. First, that demolitions provide affordable housing, and second, that preservation undermines density. I have some specific ideas as to how you can reduce demolitions while promoting density, affordable housing, and historic preservation. Obviously, we need to reduce incentives for demolition, but the main thing I think we need to do there is to fix the base zones and reconcile them with the existing built environment, design, and historic overlays. For example, RH zoning for a historic single-family home invites demolition. So it's more than just setbacks. It's more than just height. But as you pointed out in your interview, we need to tighten the envelope. This reduces the financial incentive to demolish a smaller, older home to build something out of scale. Teardowns are currently easier than building empty lots or renovation. I do want to bring up somebody you mentioned in your OPB interview, which is Mayor Nutter of Philadelphia. He recently did make some improvements to the demolition rules. They prescribed specific demolition guidelines, training, and site inspections, and the impetus was the collapse of a building under demolition that killed six people. This is not, I know we don't have money, I know we don't have time, I know we don't have staff, but six people died. And the contractor who did the demolition hung himself. So this was a few blocks from my in-law's house. But anyway, the point is that Portland's code was singled out during the lead-up to this as an especially and a good example of an effective, ineffective, vague rule. You'll see that's Portland Code 2455-100 that's cited in this article. So we can't wait a year, Mayor Hales. We can't wait even 90 days. We need to do something now. Separately, we need to reduce incentives for demolition. Oops, I'm going the wrong way. We need to increase incentives for preservation. Some specific ideas are to combine historic preservation and affordable housing incentives. BPS issued a 2007 report on credits and bonuses that is really helpful. It's on your website, Commissioner Fritz. And combining these could allow us to motivate developers to preserve rather than demolish without costing us anything. It won't cost the city anything. We should expand the historic preservation incentives to all buildings more than 50 to 75 years old, and many of those incentives include additional density for additional single-family dwellings and multi-dwelling zones. Another idea is to reduce STC fees, because currently for development that doesn't require demolition, because currently it's actually cheaper to, again, demolish than it is to rebuild on an empty lot. Oops, this is going the wrong way again. Okay, so these are some of the solutions that other cities employ. I point these out because I'm asking you to please not stop at the changes that are proposed today. Fix the code, and look creatively at bonuses and credits to provide affordable housing and density. And these aren't new ideas, because other cities are doing this today, and we deserve it too. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. Oh, yes.
And the other one. Yes. Okay, thanks.
Afternoon.
Hello. Commissioners, it is an honor to be able to speak to you today. My name is Sarah Long, and I live in Elliott, as you can see on this map here. I will at least until the wealthy developer who owns my 126-year-old home demolishes it, along with the 125-year-old home next door, and cuts down every last enormous tree. It will happen with barely a ripple of notice, because this story is extremely common and happens an average of once a day in our city. As in nearly all cases involving demolition, there is plenty of room to build additional housing, almost twice as much as the developer has planned on my home's lot, with no loss of existing homes, nor loss of even a single tree. As in nearly all cases involving demolition, my home was built using old-growth Oregon timber from trees that were hundreds of years old and had 15-foot-wide trunks. Those resources are long gone, and today they are being tossed into landfills. I would like to request a deconstruction mandate or significant incentives from you, my city council. If I must lose my home and Portland must lose this priceless resource, it shouldn't be lost forever into a landfill. And I have here graphics showing this is an overview of the Elliott neighborhood. Everywhere you see what looks like an empty asphalt lot, that is either a long since demolished building or empty unused surface parking. Elliott is one of the lowest density neighborhoods, not because we are a bunch of hoity-toities, we're actually pretty poor, but because nobody is actually building the dense buildings that it's zoned for. So if we want to increase density, please build where we can in my neighborhood. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you all.
The next three are Barbara Strunk, Barbara Kerr, and Janet Baker. And they'll be followed by Alicia Eisenstein-Kruger, Jim Gortner, and Margaret Davis.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Barbara Strunk. I'm a member of the steering committee of United Neighborhoods for Reform. I live in Beaumont, Wilshire. Deconstruction is unfinished business that we are very glad the City Council is taking up. This is not a new issue for us. Deconstruction has been part of the UNR policy since last summer, when over 2,500 people signed our petition calling for demolition permitting reform. In addition, over 40 neighborhoods associations have signed our UNR resolution that repeats the call for incentives for deconstruction. New ways of thinking about this issue are required. We propose a mandate that deconstruction is the only acceptable approach to removing all or part of a single-family residence. If this is not feasible within the city's statutory powers, then it is time to apply the city's taxing authority to make deconstruction the clearly more cost-effective choice. The 2010 Oregon DEQ study on preventing waste from the residential construction sector states that 158 homes deconstructed rather than demolished in a year saves as much carbon emission as is sequestered by Forest Park's 5,100 acres a year. The environmental arguments for deconstruction are persuasive to us in the neighborhoods. We prefer that we save our viable, affordable single-family residents and avoid their demolition altogether. But with nearly 400 demolitions a year, we are a long way from stemming this epidemic. When a house is demolished, we expect that the greenest city will require deconstruction as standard practice.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Barbara Kerr. And I am concerned about our affordable housing crisis, specifically that when houses are demolished, the replacements cannot be as affordable. For the same reasons that the greenest building is the one already built, the most affordable home is also the one already built. Plus, when single-family homes are demolished, we can lose home ownership and therefore stability in our communities. We lose stability also for our families, for current homeowners, families starting out, and in the equity and heritage that is passed down to future generations. We must disincentivize demolishing our single-family homes to curb and counter the market forces that destroy our affordable housing stock. But I am also concerned that our efforts to increase our supply are resulting in the demolition of our truly affordable homes. One step forward, three steps back. The need for affordable housing cannot be met by policies and projects that encourage demolishing our existing low-cost homes. Without our fixer-uppers, the housing stock will be affordable only for those who are not disadvantaged or who moved here from out of state. Without the truly affordable housing, the homes that are already built, people are being displaced to places that will continue the problem that it was intended to solve. Pending legislation in Salem includes increasing financing for affordable housing, directing cities and counties to ensure an adequate supply of affordable housing, and removing the ban on inclusionary zoning, thereby allowing municipalities to require developers to reserve a certain percentage of their units for low or moderate income families. All are good concepts and are for a good and necessary cause. But if they pass without conditions that protect our existing homes from demolition, the consequences will be the opposite of their intentions. If the city does not work with the state to keep those incentives for creating affordable housing from being applied where existing housing stock would be destroyed, they will be but a pretense that we are dealing with the affordability crisis. The Housing Bureau's North Northeast Neighborhood Strategy talks about helping people repair and maintain their homes. This needs to be the focus for increasing affordability. They are talking about locating new affordable housing in empty lots. That should be the rule. They talk about helping people add value to their property so they can afford to stay in their homes, for example, by adding accessory dwelling units. We must be sure this is not just talk, that it becomes citywide, and that we are using our influence to build it into state laws as well. We must save our existing affordable housing from both private and public efforts. If we really are looking out for the disadvantaged lower-income citizens and our young families, we must make sure that we are looking forward to see who will benefit, the neighbor who no longer has a neighborhood or the opportunity to own their own home or the developer who is encouraged to make their money under the guise of sacrifice for the common good. We know that the city intends to do the right thing, but we're not sure that we are not committing the urban renewal mistake of the 21st century.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
My name's Janet Baker, and I live in the Beaumont neighborhood. I'm also a member of the steering committee. I want to, again, talk about affordability for first-time home buyers and also even middle-income buyers in Portland. This group of buyers is finding it increasingly difficult, if not impossible, to find an affordable home within the city. In several DRAC meetings and neighborhood meetings I've attended, developers have rationalized the teardown trend in Portland, and particularly in the kind of neighborhood I live in, as being driven by a lack of executive housing, saying we need more executive housing to succeed in economic development. First of all, speaking as someone who's had to read a lot of economic development literature in my professional life, I can tell you that lack of executive housing is rarely a limited factor in economic development. Usually the limitations are lack of industrial land, lack of infrastructure, lack of good water quality, and certainly land's been an issue in Portland, and probably nothing could be as serious as what's going on with the Port of Portland right now in limiting potential for future economic development. If there is a housing factor in the company's decision to locate in a particular city or region, the issue is usually a concern about affordability for employees, not executive housing. But let's say you do believe we have a lack of executive housing. I want to share with you some year-end housing stats. In the real estate industry, you should probably know, inventory of houses is often expressed as inventory in months. It's defined as the active residential listing at the end of the month divided by the number of closed sales for that month. 5.5 months is usually considered a balance point. So anything under that, and it's a seller's market, and it's been a seller's market in Portland for the last 3 years at least. So let's look at Multnomah County and look at the inventory in two price brackets, and you have a chart attached to your first page there. In the under 350,000 price bracket, where first-time home buyers would be, there's 1.7 months of inventory in December of 2014. But in the $600,000 to $1.1 million range, the bracket in which developers are selling their executive homes, the inventory is 2.9 months. You can see that this trend has been that same. I picked one point in time just to simplify it, but the trend is the same for the whole chart. The realtor who provided me this data said, What the data clearly tells us is the inventory is low in all price ranges. When the builders use this lack of executive housing as their justification for teardowns, it's ridiculous. If you want to use this argument, she said, you would need to tear down expensive houses so you could build cheaper houses, because that's where we have a bigger shortfall. This lack of affordable homes is going to continue if we continue to demolish these homes. Only this morning, the Portland Chronicle reported another 40 demolition permits issued between the time of our December 17th hearing and today. And that doesn't even count the virtual demolitions. It's an urgent problem, one we can't sit on for another day or another hearing. The next speaker who will be speaking to us from our group has some hands-on experience that I don't have. I'm all about numbers, and she can talk about real first-time home buyers.
Well, thank you for the numbers. Thank you. Thanks to all three.
The next three are Alyssa Eisenstein-Kruger, Jim Gorder, and Margaret Davis. And they'll be followed by Terry Parker, Sharon Genesi, and Judy Parsons.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So my name is Alyssa Eisenstein-Kruger, and I'm a real estate broker with Living Room Realty. The majority of my clients are first-time home buyers, and this past year, and even more in this past few months, have been the most difficult market to be a buyer in all of the years that I've been working in real estate. Given the market trend of a lack of supply and a huge demand for houses, the market is not likely to get much better for would-be home buyers for quite some time. My first-time homebuyers have been pre-approved by lenders and are looking for Portland's once-plentiful, humble little starter homes, willing to pay up to $350,000 for a small home with space for children, a garden, a pet. They want to buy Portland's older homes with flexible spaces like unfinished basements or attics that can be converted to living space as their needs change and their families grow. And they are not deterred by a home that needs a little elbow grease. Most importantly, they want to live in the communities where they have connections, where the neighborhoods have character and amenities they can walk to, like stores, schools, and transit lines. The problem, so are developers. Developers bring cash, they waive all financing contingencies, they don't have the homes inspected, and can close on a house in less than 5 business days. More often than not, a developer is purchasing a home with the intent to demolish or significantly alter the home and then build a house that sells for over $650,000. Every time this happens, we lose another home for our, from our city's stock of affordable houses. That home will never again be an entryway into homeownership for hardworking families and individuals who see the benefits of homeownership and want to take part. In its place is a home that, for most of the time, is not in character with the surrounding homes and is unaffordable to 99% of first-time homebuyers. Every time this happens, my first-time homebuyers are discouraged, angry, and heartbroken. Not only do they lose out on yet another house to a cash developer, but that house that they had pictured themselves living in will be crunched up and sent to a landfill. Additionally, many of the homes that have been demolished over the past couple of years were never put on the open market. They were acquired by developers who send letters to homeowners offering to purchase their home for quick cash. This tends to go to elderly people, and many of these sellers are vulnerable, and they do not understand that they may be receiving less than market value by selling their home in this manner, and that the buyer of their home tends to demolish it and replace it with a much more expensive home. In addition to providing notice to surrounding homes and the neighborhood associations, those seeking demolition permits should be required to obtain a notarized signature of the home seller, stating that they understand that their home will be demolished. No signature from the seller means no permit for demolition. I am also a partner broker with the Portland Housing Center, and this past Saturday I presented the Shopping for Your Home section at the Home Buying 101 class. There were 42 people in the class, and when I asked how many of the class participants were planning on purchasing a home under $250,000, 36 out of the 42 raised their hands. This would have been a realistic goal for all of these home buyers only a couple years ago, but with the dramatic rise in property values and the loss of humble homes to demolition, it's obviously not going to be a reality for most of these people. As a city who is dedicated to maintaining diversity in all forms and in all levels, we need to consider the impact that demolition of habitable and affordable homes has on our greater community and work on solutions to keep these homes out of the jaws of the backhoe and available for future generations of families.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
And the one thing that you mentioned about people sending letters to maybe potentially vulnerable sellers, you know, seeing if they're willing to sell their house.
Yes.
And does state law currently regulate any part of that? Are there any requirements that,
as far as I know, no.
So no requirement that you that the offer contains, say, language that says you are encouraged to seek the advice of a real estate professional, or
nope.
You might want to have your house appraised or talk to someone.
No.
And how do you how are you able to track those transactions? I mean, we know they're going on, but
we know they're going on. Again, I hearsay. Anecdotal, but I also I'm on a lot of the Facebook groups about demolishing Portland, and there's anecdotal stuff. I also just know that from talking to folks whose neighbors suddenly the house is being demolished, and the little old lady who sold it to a nice young couple who turned out to be a developer.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Jim Gorder. I live in the South Burlingame area, and I am speaking on behalf of United Neighborhoods for Reform. Thank you, Mayor Hales, for your commitment to working to on the infill standards and development process. As requested by 40 neighborhood associations, we call for the creation of a task force to make the comprehensive plans policies 5.33 and 4.13 for the production of affordable housing and neighborhood character a reality, and to address community concerns in these areas. We call for the creation of this task force by March 1st of this year. I'm going to make a couple other comments which are going to be mine. They haven't been vetted by United Neighborhoods, so they're going to be mine. First, when a home is scheduled for demolition, I think the developer should and the owner should be required to keep it in habitable condition if at all possible, maintain utilities, keep the roof on, keep out transients, not remove woodwork, not remove furnace, and so forth. Second, we're talking about a notification of neighbors. I think the notification of neighbors should include a city contact number for the concerns and complaints about dust and hazardous materials and other things, and I think that a sign should be posted at all demolition and construction sites with a common city phone number where people can call, express their concerns, and ask questions. We have it now for erosion concerns. Let's put a common number for everything all together and have that number manned by a real person who can direct it to the appropriate person.
You just
agency.
Made Commissioner Fritz's day. I just want to say that. She is the champion for a 311 system. That would be a common number for many things.
Good.